Okay, I guess I'll get started. First of all, about references. One reference that may be useful is some proceedings of some summer school lectures I gave about 10 years ago. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy with me. They're not on the web, and they're not in the UCSB library, so may not be very immediately useful. If anybody here happens to have a copy, perhaps they could make it available.
Is it the Lezouche
lectures? Yeah. Okay. You have one? And Tony Z has a copy, so you could ask him for one. Yeah, I would have brought a copy with me if I'd realized I was going to be doing this, of course. Anyway, I'll give the reference for what it's worth. So this was Lezouche Lectures, 1988. There's also a large number of other review articles around on Bosonization. Quite a few have come out recently. They all have, unfortunately, nobody has the same notation as anybody else. It's one of the problems in this field. There are other differences that are slightly more substantial than that, especially having to do with so-called Klein factors. But I'll give one reference which may be of some help. So this is on the web. So it's a review article by Von Delft and Scholler. So here, let me just say, C, Tony Z. Okay, sir. I'm totally harassed.
No, I'll
just give my copy. Okay, see me in that case, right. And finally, there's one more thing. I covered some of this. Well, I covered actually a lot of this stuff in a course I taught just last spring, and had my notes with me. So in fact, I've got about 50 or 60 pages of notes here, which I'm lecturing from. So I actually gave them to Dan Hohn yesterday. I think eventually they're going to be appearing on the ITP website. Yeah. Actually, if they could get on today, that would be good, because they might be most useful actually later today to prepare for tomorrow's lecture.
Why can't a Xerox be
easier? Or, yeah, correct. If you want to Xerox them, it's fine. Dan thought he didn't want to make...
Because it's 55
pages. It's about 55 pages, so it seemed like... Anyway, I've got a copy here, so anybody who wants to photocopy them can. Also my lecture notes. These are handwritten lecture notes. So either see the ITP website eventually, or ask me. And I'm going to give some a couple of homework exercises today, actually. So, and I should explain, these notes are probably perhaps almost insultingly pedantic, because they were meant for a graduate course with some first-year graduate students. So some of the stuff clearly is not really needed for this audience. So let me just say a little bit about what I'm hoping to cover. First of all, I see bosonization as part of sort of a package of techniques that are useful for studying one-dimensional strongly correlated systems. Most of the techniques, it's probably fair to say, are sort of loosely connected to quantum field theory or elementary particle theory, although if you look at the history of these areas, they have a very complicated interplay between people from the condensed matter side and the particle physics side. In fact, I guess a lot of this stuff on bosonization was actually developed simultaneously by Sidney Coleman and by Luther, both of whom were actually at Harvard. This was around 1975, and neither one actually discovered that they were working on the same problem at the same time until after Luther had left, I think, and gone to Denmark, and then they eventually got this straightened out. So there's quite a bit of duplication in the history of the subject, and part of the reason for the sort of different notation, different point of view, I think, is that these things were kind of developed in isolation in two different communities, and eventually people sort of realized that there's many ways of doing the same thing. I won't really try to cover the history anyway. But I did want to emphasize that, at least from my perspective, this is really part of a package, and I wanted to cover a bit more of the rest of the package. This, the way I would look at it, bosonization is probably best thought of as a nice way of dealing with relativistic fermion problems in one space, one time dimension, and turning them into relativistic boson problems. So as such, the first thing I want to discuss is if we start with some condensed matter model of interest, like the Hubbard model or Heisenberg chain, the first thing I would like to discuss is how at low energies, this is approximately equivalent to a relativistic quantum field theory in 1 plus 1 dimension. That's really the first point. So I want to spend a bit of time on that. So the first point really would be what I would call the continuum limit of a lattice model or relativistic quantum field theory. That's to say Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. And the next part of the package, which is really just all tied up with the subject, and you couldn't really make so much sense out of the subject if you didn't think about this other aspect, and that's the renormalization group. So I think renormalization group is really quite important for understanding bosonization. And that's sort of for several reasons. I mean, one of them is that bosonization is a nice way of understanding how to do renormalization group in the subject. And also at a deeper level, renormalization group is, after all, just the area of basically writing down effective Hamiltonians valid at low energies or long wavelengths by eliminating short distance modes. And one really has to have that sort of approach in mind to make sense out of bosonization, or even to make sense out of this, because the relativistic quantum field theory only arises, in fact, after eliminating short distance degrees of freedom. So it's only approximately valid. Nonetheless, these approaches can give some exact results at long wavelengths and low energies, and the reason for that is basically all tied up with renormalization group ideas. So these things are all kind of tied up together. And then finally, bosonization. So I'm going to be roughly heading through these topics in my lecture today. Now, there are actually many different problems to which bosonization can be applied. And I certainly won't have time in 3 hours to discuss all of them. I want to discuss a few. So the plan is to, first of all, just sort of give some general sort of theoretical background. And then I want to focus on, in fact, I'm going to start very briefly with the Hubbard model in one dimension, but only at half filling. And then I'm going to go from the Hubbard model to the spin and half Heisenberg model. And the detailed applications of these methods will be to the spin and half Heisenberg model. I think it's fair to say that the applications so far that have been the most useful, say, for example, in comparing to experiments, have all been probably been on the spin and half Heisenberg model, although there are many, many other applications. And in fact, by now, there's many results on the Heisenberg model, which have come from bosonization. I won't even have time to discuss all of these, but I want to discuss a few of them. So in particular, I want to talk actually about the susceptibility, including these logarithmic corrections. I want to talk about neutron scattering cross-section, or what's called S of Q and omega. That is to say, the wave vector and frequency-dependent spin-spin correlation function. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about, there are various various effects that will produce gaps in the spin-and-half. So the spin-and-half Heisenberg model is gapless, as we will be seeing from this approach. But there are various terms you can add to the Hamiltonian which produce gaps, some of which are very important and relevant for certain types of experiments. And in particular, related to the spin pyrrhals phenomena, if we have alternating interactions that produce a gap, alternating exchange interactions, or also a staggered field produces a gap. Now, adding a staggered field might seem like an academic exercise, but in fact, there are experimental situations in which staggered fields effectively arise. These can arise in systems where one has two inequivalent spins per unit cell, and one, for example, has a paramagnetic cancer, which has different values in alternating sites, and they can also arise from Zelishinsky-Maria interactions. So in fact, we've been quite involved recently in developing theory based on bosonization to understand what happens in a staggered field. And I think I'd probably like to spend a bit of time discussing this particular application of bosonization. So, and maybe we won't really have time for this one, but in fact, these are actually very related anyway, it turns out.
Does that include anisotropic exchange?
Yeah, probably will not. I mean, yeah. Anisotropic exchange or XXZ model is also, XXE model is also, of course, another important application. I probably won't have time for that. So let me make, in fact, a list of things I probably won't have time for. I'd be happy to talk about them privately, or if everybody isn't bored after three lectures, maybe consider having some more. But other applications are XXE model. So it turns out the generalization of the Heisenberg case to XXE is extremely simple using bosonization. And then we have, well, all kinds of more complicated models. So, you know, Hubbard model away from half-filling. All kinds of ladder models. Kondo lattice models. So these are all basically one-dimensional models where we just add more degrees of freedom. So we have two chains of spin and halves or three chains, or we have some conducting chains and some insulating chains. So one can try to apply bosonization techniques with various degrees of success to all of these problems. And then there's actually another whole class of problems. These problems all have translational invariants. And then we have impurity problems. So, for example, we have single impurity Kondo problem. We have a single defect in a quantum wire. We have magnetic defects in spin and half chains. So there's various single impurity problems. And one can also discuss finite densities of randomly located impurities using, for example, replica tricks. So that's probably a survey of most of the problems to which one can usefully apply bosonization. I should emphasize that bosonization is not does not allow you to stop thinking. You still have to think about these problems, and every time you try to apply bosonization to a new problem, you're likely to discover some new wrinkle. And when you're thinking about it, you have to sort of constantly go back and think about randomization groups. And the fact that you've got an approach which is valid at best at low energies after eliminating long distance degrees of freedom. And there's always various assumptions inherent in the whole approach, and they don't always work. So there are lots of surprises and complications. But I think in general it's fair to say that bosonization has been extremely successful and has led to a lot of understanding of low energy, long distance behavior of one-dimensional, strongly correlated systems. Pardon? This is 1D. Everything here is 1D, right? Yeah. There have also been some efforts to generalize bosonization to higher dimensions. So far, I think they have not led to enormously useful results. I won't have time to talk about them anyway. Okay. So the program then is to sort of starts here then to start by talking about the Hubbard model and half filling. And in fact, what I wanted to do was sort of run through these steps. So I wanted to discuss the continuum limit, how we map this into a relativistic quantum field theory, say a few words about renormalization group, and that will kind of motivate bosonization as a nice way of understanding how this model behaves. And the connection between the Hubbard model and Heisenberg model will be the well-known one, namely if you take the infinite infinite coupling limit of the Hubbard model, you in fact, at half-filling, you recover the Heisenberg model. So we'll follow this route to get, in fact, to the Heisenberg model, eventually using bosonization. So this in fact, is only one way of getting bosonization for the Heisenberg model. There's another totally, quite independent way, which, in fact, I will also not have time to discuss. And this, by the way, a lot of this stuff goes back to some beautiful work by Dan Mattis and collaborators, especially Elliot Lieb, I should certainly mention. So another way of making the connection or basically bosonizing the Heisenberg model is not to go via the Hubbard model, but instead to use the so-called Jordan-Vigner transformation, where you can exactly represent the Heisenberg model, or in general the XXZ model, by spinless fermions. So it's like a kind of a Hubbard model, except where the fermions don't carry spin. Then one can again take a continuum limit, get a relativistic quantum field theory, apply these steps, bosonize, and arrive at a bosonized version of the Heisenberg model. So these are two more or less independent ways of representing the Heisenberg model by bosons. In the end, you get exactly the same representation using both approaches. Both approaches have their drawbacks and their advantages. I really won't have time to discuss both in these lectures, so I'm going to focus on this particular approach. If you want to read about the other approach, for example, it's discussed in my Lesueux lecture notes and probably all kinds of other places. This approach, I would say, is a little bit more physical. In that, of course, we're also interested in bosonizing the Hubbard model, so it doesn't hurt to discuss that en route towards the Heisenberg model. So, well, compared to what's in my notes here, or what's in the lectures I gave to some graduate students, I'm going to go quite a bit faster and skip some things which I think are probably well known to almost everybody in the audience. But please feel free to stop me and ask questions at any time. Okay, so start with the Hubbard model. So let me just write the Hamiltonian to establish a notation. So one-dimensional Hubbard model. So I'll write psi. Psi I will be my electron annihilation operator plus Hermitian conjugate. I have spin indices around, so I should sum over spin. And Hubbard model at half filling, I can write the interaction term as the electron density minus 1 squared, where Ni is psi I sigma. And repeated spin indices will often be summed. Okay, so the dispersion relation for this model, of course, is minus 2t cosine of k. And if I'm at half filling, the Fermi wave vectors are plus or minus pi over 2. Actually, I see in my lecture notes I tried to keep... I may try to keep the finite lattice spacing A, although I may occasionally forget and set it equal to 1. So we'll try to keep the lattice spacing A in the problem. Okay, so... now what I'd like to do is pass to a discussion of the low energy degrees of freedom of the Hubbard model in one dimension at half filling. Now you might immediately object that maybe I'm throwing away too much if I do this, because I said that I wanted to get the Heisenberg model from the Hubbard model, and in fact the Heisenberg model actually arises in the infinite U limit of the Hubbard model, in which case it's not at all clear we're only concerned with low energy degrees of freedom. Nonetheless, it turns out that by understanding the low energy degrees of freedom of the Hubbard model, and by making a reasonable conjecture, we can in fact also understand what happens at low energies in the Hubbard model even when U is large. So initially I'll sort of be pretending that I'm concerned with small U, but then I'm going to do a kind of extrapolation to infinite U a little bit later, as we will see. So let's for the moment focus on low energy degrees of freedom, and let's imagine initially that U is small. So we think about a kind of a perturbative approach. So the first question we might ask is, well, when U is zero, where of course we just have free electron states, what are the low energy degrees of freedom? Well, low energy degrees of freedom, of course, are just electrons and holes very close to the Fermi points. And the unique feature of one dimension is that the Fermi surface breaks into two disconnected pieces at these wave vectors plus or minus pi over 2a. So it's convenient to consider little slices of momentum space near the Fermi surfaces, or Fermi points. And I'll often consider this. Let's consider a little strip of excitations of width 2 lambda in momentum space, and where lambda is some parameter which is chosen to be much less than the bandwidth, or much less than pi over 2a. And let's just focus on degrees of freedom corresponding to electron excitations, electron or hole or particle hole excitations in this region of momentum space. So it's when we focus on these degrees of freedom that all these magic tricks will work. We get a relativistic quantum field theory, we can bosonize, et cetera, et cetera. As soon as we wander out of this region, basically all these techniques fail. But nonetheless, by some certain types of extrapolations, we can actually learn quite a bit, even in situations where it's not obvious that it's enough to consider this region. Okay, so, and by the way, this is really the first place that the renormalization group sort of comes in, because if I want to do this properly, what I really want to imagine doing is integrating out momentum modes everywhere except in this little narrow strip. And the logic is, if I'm trying to calculate correlation functions at long distances, then as long as the distances I'm considering are large compared to 1 over lambda, then I can get away with this kind of reduction. And this reduction will be useful because, in fact, then I will have a nice relativistic quantum field theory to which I can apply these techniques. Because I want to consider low energy, long distance behavior of the model. That's all I'm really focusing on. And this I would argue, is connected to these low energy excitations near the Fermi points. So it's similar to what one does in Fermi liquid theory. One only considers excitations near the Fermi surface. Well, I mean, this is half filling. Okay, I'm at half filling. So the Fermi surface is here. Okay. Yeah, so consider adding or removing a few electrons at the lowest possible energies, or creating particle hole excitations. Yeah. Actually, it's an insulator, but we'll get to that in a minute for finite U, positive U. Okay, so what I want to do then is represent my fermion operators in terms of basically operators which create excitations near the two Fermi points. So we have a very important formula in this game. I'll introduce operators that annihilate what I call left and right moving fermions. So I can write e to the I pi over 2 a, well, pi over 2 times j times psi right of aj plus e to the minus I pi over 2 j psi left of A times J. So these operators then annihilate electrons in the vicinity of these two points on the Fermi surface. And I assume that psi right and psi left only have Fourier modes less than the lambda in magnitude. So I've just thrown away everything else. I'm focusing on low energy degrees of freedom. And that means that in position space, these are slowly varying fields. So this is the so-called continuum limit. I have fields that vary slowly on the scale of the lattice spacing. And by making this drastic simplification, the Hamiltonian takes on a form for which I can apply all these techniques. So the Hamiltonian, then, in this approximation, if I write it, in fact, in position space, I can write it as I times V Fermi, integral dx minus infinity to infinity. So I've gone from sums to integrals, because things are varying slowly on a lattice scale, minus psi right dagger d by dx psi right plus psi left dagger d by dx psi left. This corresponds to a linearized dispersion relation. In other words, epsilon is V Fermi times K minus K Fermi. Well, so if the electron dispersion relation is read as actually K plus or minus, no, read as K plus or minus K Fermi, where K Fermi is pi over 2a.
Just
Yeah, well, that's also true. In fact, this is the Hamiltonian, but it's also strongly related to the momentum operator.
Right, so
that's right.
Like these.
Yeah, in fact, if I took the difference of these two things instead of, if I took the sum of these two things instead of the difference, this would be the momentum operator. So it's only the fact that I've got a minus sign which tells me it's the Hamiltonian, not the momentum. Okay?
Right and left, that gives you this sign.
Okay, it just follows actually from this shift. The minus sign here is just related to the fact that I have a plus or minus sign in exponent. Yeah, I think the correct statement is the difference of these two is actually the energy, and the sum of these two is the momentum, is the statement, because of course, I guess the right formula is for right movers, the energy is approximately B Fermi K minus KF.
I think what you call momentum is probably what you call the bottom
end. I don't think so. And for left movers, the energy, in fact, is B Fermi minus K plus KF. All right, there's just a change in sign. Dispersion relation changes sign if I go to the left branch. So that basically gives me this minus sign. Okay. Okay. Now, let me just point out at this point that this Hamiltonian, in fact, has Lorentz invariance, which is a somewhat useful point. It makes me contact with relativistic quantum field theory. That's perhaps especially clear if we write the Lagrangian. So we can immediately write a Lagrangian corresponding to this Hamiltonian. And let me also, in general, I'm going to set velocities equal to 1. So let me set the velocity to 1 for the time being. This is standard notation in relativistic quantum field theory where the speed of light is often set equal to 1. What's playing the role of speed of light here is Fermi velocity. So if you write this Lagrangian corresponding to this Hamiltonian, we get dt minus dx for the left movers and dt plus dx for the right movers. And now it's more or less obvious that this is Lorentz invariant, because what does a Lorentz transformation look like? Well, in one space, one time dimension, Lorentz transformations are very simple. They take t plus or minus x, and they transform them by a boost, by some angle theta, e plus or minus theta times t plus or minus x. And you can easily check that this corresponds to the usual Lorentz transformation that mixes time and space involving hyperbolic angles. So this is a Lorentz transformation. And it follows immediately that if we take these derivatives, d plus minus, which I define to be dt plus or minus dx, they just transform in the opposite way. So we see that these are so-called light cone derivatives because they involve x equals plus or minus t corresponds to a particle moving along the light cone. So under Lorentz transformation, these light cone derivatives pick up these phases, well, not phases, but these amplitudes e to the plus or minus theta. And we see that we can define a Lorentz transformation for the fermions. We can define psi left to transform as e to the theta over 2 psi left, or psi right to transform as e to the minus theta over 2 psi right. And with such a transformation, this Lagrangian will be invariant under these Lorentz transformations. So we see that, in fact, we have a Lorentz invariant theory here. And in fact, this theory has been well studied by quantum field theorists and is known as a Dirac, basically a massless Dirac fermion Lagrangian. And of course, non-interacting at this point. So this is going to start to become useful once we put in interactions. Okay. Also, of course, we can make a mode expansion for these operators in terms of creation annihilation operators. But let me not bother writing it down, but just comment that if we want to make the connection with the relativistic quantum field theory, then basically, electrons or electrons, but holes basically correspond to positrons. So we can sort of forget about the fact that we started with a Fermi surface and just pretend that we have a vacuum and two types of particles present, electrons and positrons, and then that's the interpretation that corresponds to the relativistic quantum field theory. Of course, in the condensed matter problem, we actually have holes, but this is sort of running the logic backwards because that's more or less what Dirac argued when he first proposed positrons in the first place. Inspired by the notion of holes in condensed matter physics, he suggested that maybe there could be some anti-electrons around, which he called positrons. So we can just kind of, and this actually led, in fact, to these Lorentz invariant field theory, so we can just kind of run this argument backwards. Did he? Okay. All right, thanks. Okay, so let me now consider what happens when I put in the Hubbard interaction. So now I want to use this low-energy approach, throw away everything but low-energy degrees of freedom, write the Hamiltonian in terms of left and right movers, and now include the Hubbard interaction. And for the moment, we should imagine that we have a small u, because if we have a large u, it's rather difficult to justify only considering states near the Fermi surface. If we have a small u, it seems like a natural thing to do if we're considering low-energy behavior. So it's straightforward to write the Hubbard interaction in terms of these left and right movers. So in particular, let's consider the number density operator, psi dag or j psi j. Well, we can use the formula up there at the top and write this in terms of left and right movers. And we get the following expression. Psi right dagger, psi right, plus psi left dagger, psi left, plus minus 1 to the j. Psi right dagger, psi left, plus psi left dagger, psi right. I'm suppressing spin indices here, but of course they just come along for the ride. Now we can write the Hubbard interaction. So the interaction term, well, it's just it's some tedious algebra, basically, to plug this and square this thing, subtract 1, actually square it, and write everything out. And we get a collection of various types of terms. Notice that we're going to have some terms that have oscillating factors minus 1 to the j. We will drop those terms. Justification being that, remember, we're assuming that these fields, psi right and psi left, only have small Fourier modes. So the minus 1 to the j oscillations will basically wipe out those terms. And that simplifies a bit the terms that remain. The terms that remain after a little bit of massaging take on a rather simple form. So, well, obviously it's proportional to u. We pull out a factor of lattice spacing. We have an integral over x. And then we have some terms. I'm going to introduce some notation here, which I'll explain in a minute. I'll write in terms of currents. So we have, in fact, j right squared plus j left squared. Minus 4 j left dot j right. Oh, sorry, I'll explain this notation momentarily, and I seem to have dropped some terms here. So where do they go? Also got some terms of the form, let's see. No, actually, that's correct so far. Okay, plus J right, J left. Also a term of the form J left squared, J right squared, involving vector signs. And then finally we have the so-called umklapp term, one-half, I guess two times psi left dagger up, spin up, psi left dagger down, psi right up, psi right down, plus remission conjugate. So that, I think, is everything we get. And what does this notation mean? Well, by J left, I mean psi left dagger, psi left, minus, actually, its vacuum expectation value. And by vacuum here, I mean the filled Fermi C for this problem. And implicitly here, I'm summing over spin indices. Subtraction of the vacuum expectation value really just corresponds to the fact that my Hubbard interaction I wrote is n minus 1 squared, so I'm subtracting off the average value of n. That's basically taken care of here. Likewise for J right. Okay, I have some J's that have vector signs over the top. I have some J's that don't. Okay, is that the question? Yeah, let me explain that. The J's with vector signs are involve spin. So J left with a vector sign refers to psi left dagger times a Pauli matrix, psi left, where I sum over spin indices. So I should explain the physical interpretation of these things. These are basically charge currents or densities. Well, they're currents and densities at the same time, which comes back to your earlier question, okay? Because if we have right-moving particles, if all the particles are moving at the same speed to the right, then basically the density and the charge are the same thing. And likewise, if they're all moving to the left at the same speed, then the charge simply equals minus the density. So these are really both at the same time densities and charges for left and right moving electrons. So in fact, the total charge is actually the sum of these left and right moving guys, and the total current is the difference of these guys. And here we're talking about charge, densities, and currents. And now we have a similar thing for spin. We can also define spin densities and currents. But now they involve this vector sign. Okay, so this is basically just what you get by squaring this thing, plugging it in, and grinding through some algebra. And it's, well, basically everything that's sort of allowed by symmetry is sitting there, so it's not surprising. That's what you get.
Can you define take the original Hubbard model, change the power of the new term, instead of n minus 1 squared.
Yeah.
Consider both odd and even powers, right?
Yeah.
In the large U limit, if the power is even, it seems that the microscopic physics should be the same. But the field theory looks very different. You pick up.
Okay, I think what's going to happen is, first of all, I think you're still going to pick up quartic terms, but you're also going to pick up a general sixth order or higher order terms as well. So what I'm now going to do is analyze these terms with the normalization group. The higher order terms, in fact, are going to be irrelevant in the normalization group sense. And the only thing which is going to matter crucially is going to be the sign of the quartic terms. So at least when all these coupling constants are small, I would argue that all I really care about is the sign of the quartic terms. I think that's correct. Of course, when the couplings get large, various funny things can happen, which go beyond a simple-minded treatment.
It seems to me interesting that in the Hubbard model, the powers are off, and the physics of course different than the physics. Different terms here.
Well, let's see. I think in the vicinity of weak coupling, I should think about that, but I would, my first response right off the cuff is, in the weak coupling limit, adding, say, cubic or quartic terms isn't going to make an enormous difference. The important thing is just going to be the net coefficient of this quartic term, where all these couplings are small. Yeah, so you can add a quartic plus sixth order plus eighth order.
But eventually you're going to go with the U, right?
Yeah, and that may indeed make some difference, right? But I'll come to that a little bit later.
Could the normalization of these higher order terms not change the sign of the quartic term?
Yeah, so what we're going to do, that's also true, but I guess if all the couplings are weak, I expect that the normalization of the quartic terms by the higher order terms will be small and isn't going to lead to a big change in the phase diagram.
The vacuum exhibition, does the spin current zero?
At zero, yeah, basically. For example, if you take the Z component, you've got the point is, in zero magnetic field, it's zero, okay, because, for example, for the Z component, the density of up movers and down movers, spin up and spin down electrons will be equal, and they'll cancel. Yeah, if we had a magnetic field around, we might also subtract this, but for the moment, there's no magnetic field, so it's not necessary, right. So notice that I could write everything, all these interaction terms were written in terms of these currents, except for one. And this is the so-called umklapp term. And physical interpretation here is we're taking a couple of electrons from the right branch of the Fermi surface to the left branch. One can also generalize this away from half-filling. So far, I am at half-filling. The fact that I was at half-filling played an important role, basically because I had a phase factor minus 1 to the j. In general, this would be e to the I 2k Fermi times aj. And in general, this would be oscillating at some phase. It would not be simply pi. In fact, where this term came from actually was basically from squaring this, the square of this term. So we see that, in fact, this term is only present at half-filling. If I was at any other filling, there would have been 4k Fermi times aj phase sitting here, and this would have washed out this term in this limit where lambda is small and these fields very slowly. So the special feature of half-filling is the presence of a Zumklapp term. Or more physically, the point is, of course, transporting two electrons across the Fermi surface conserves crystal momentum only at half-filling. So it's a process which is present in the Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, one of the reasons I've chosen to write the Hamiltonian this way is to emphasize symmetries. And in fact, symmetries are going to play an important role in basically everything I have to say in these lectures. And I'll try to always keep explicitly keep track of all the symmetries. In particular, note that, well, of course, the Hubbard Hamiltonian has spin symmetry. So these conserved charges or densities are related, of course, to the conserved charge and spin. So most of the terms in the Hamiltonian I've been able to write in terms of these things. And notice that we don't have any cross terms between spin and charge densities. So we only have terms that are either entirely written in terms of charge densities or entirely written in terms of spin densities. The exception to that seems to be the umklapp term. But notice that, in fact, if you look at the structure of the umklapp term, we're annihilating a pair of electrons in a singlet state and creating on the right branch and creating a pair of electrons in a singlet state on the left branch. So this also, in some sense, seems to be a kind of a spin singlet process. And I'll make that point more clear a little bit later. But an important point is going to be that this Hamiltonian is going to sort of separate into charge pieces and spin pieces. And spin-charge separation is sort of inherent in the form of the Hamiltonian. It sort of starts at this level because we have terms that only seem to somehow involve charge and terms that only involve spin. And indeed, the main motivation or the main advantage of bosonization, I would say, for this Hamiltonian is the fact that we can kind of separate the Hamiltonian into charge and spin pieces. In the sense we've already done it, more or less, for the interaction term, we also need to sort of separate the non-interacting part into charge and spin pieces. And then we have to be able to argue that somehow these are really behaving independently. And that's really one of the big advantages we obtain from bosonization. Okay, so before I discuss bosonization of this Hamiltonian, I want to say a few words about renormalization. Is there a question? Question? Okay, it's not completely clear, but all I'm saying is this annihilates a spin singlet. This annihilates a pair of electrons in a spin singlet state. So in that sense, we're transporting a spin singlet pair across the Fermi surface. So it seems to be kind of a charge process rather than a spin process, but that's not completely clear, perhaps.
Spin singlet because X is the same, right?
Yeah, everything here is local. Right, sorry, it should have been clear. So in position space, also, the point is this is manifestly a singlet. We're creating, this is a Cooper pair, if you want. This annihilates a Cooper pair at one place in space. So it's necessarily in a singlet state.
But okay. There's nothing that can happen in the continuum limit. For instance, many x points are condensing to one point. The continuum limit does not have a
I should say that actually I've already, in fact, dropped a bunch of other terms. I should really comment on that. And again, it comes back to a normalization group. What are the terms that I've dropped here? I've dropped all kinds of terms involving derivatives, which comes back to Rajiv's point. Because really, well, for one reason or another, I could have argued, I guess in this context, probably where the derivative terms would come from is, for example, from integrating out these higher momentum modes. So there's various processes that could have given me additional derivative terms. And I could have had terms, for example, where I stuck in some derivatives here, psi right, d by dx psi right. In that case, I could have, in fact, had parallel spins. And I could have had processes where I transported spin one Cooper pair across the Fermi surface. But such processes only involve higher derivative terms. And what I'm going to argue shortly is that, in fact, these are the only terms that are relevant or marginal in the normalization group sense. The higher derivative terms are irrelevant, and therefore I expect that I can ignore them. But I need to justify that a little bit more from a normalization group. So, yeah, I think at this level you wouldn't get them, but if you're a little bit more careful about if you're a bit more careful about eliminating the higher momentum modes in a kind of perturbative process, taking into account the fact that the Hubbard interaction will actually couple higher momentum modes to lower momentum modes, then if you do some elimination process where you integrate out higher momentum modes, you're going to start generating new interactions for lower momentum modes. And in general, anything which is allowed by symmetry will occur. So you'd certainly make small corrections to these various coupling constants. You could also generate all kinds of other terms. And if you start asking, well, what other terms are possible, if you write them in terms of local operators, what you immediately see is going to start arising are derivative terms. Yeah, but I'm being a little bit cavalier here. If U is small, the other terms, all the corrections are going to be suppressed by powers of U squared over T, or U over T. So they're going to be small anyway, and furthermore, perhaps more importantly, they're going to be irrelevant in the normalization group sense, so that they won't make big changes in the conclusions from this model, at least when U over T is small. Yes, that's right. But in condensed matter physics, we're quite happy with non-normalizable theories. It's sort of a matter of... the point is, in condensed matter physics, we always have an ultraviolet cutoff. And in fact, it's not horribly large. It's just a lattice spacing, an angstrom or so. And we're always concerned with physics, or at least for using this kind of approach, we're always concerned with physics at much longer length scales. So we're really trying to go up to long length scales with a fixed ultraviolet cutoff. And we're not ever concerned really with taking the ultraviolet cutoff to infinity. Particle physicists have the opposite problem. They're very much concerned with taking the ultraviolet cutoff to infinity and often don't want to go out to particularly long length scales anyway. They'd be happy to study about a Fermi or so. In that case, it creates a big problem if they have non-normalizable interactions because they're ultraviolet divergences when the cutoff goes to infinity. But in condensed matter physics, that's never a problem because we're not taking our cutoff to infinity. What we're concerned with, in fact, is infrared divergences. And they're actually connected with renormalizable interactions. So in condensed matter physics, it's the renormalizable interactions that may cause trouble because they can produce infrared divergences. And the non-normalizable ones are fine because we're not concerned with taking our cutoff to infinity.
But even in particle physics, for example, if we calculate the g minus 2 of the electron,
yeah.
Suppose there's a non-normalizable term, but it's associated with physics at some very high scale, like 10 to the 10 degree.
Yeah.
We also.
Yeah. Well, we know that such effects are going to be suppressed by ratios of scales. Yeah.
Right. But it's the same reason. Isn't it?
Yeah. That's right. More or less. Yeah.
Can I ask you another question? The argument you've given, that's sort of a suppose in the original Hubbard model, I put in some nearest neighbor version of the U term. This
yep.
is a quick argument to say that terms like that is irrelevant.
What it's going to do is renormalize these coupling constants. So more generally, I could have put sort of arbitrary numbers here, okay? Arbitrary coupling constants.
Well,
these will change.
The change.
Yeah, this is basically everything I can write down which is relevant. Well, let me explain what I mean by relevant here. All I really mean is everything I can write down that involves four fermion fields and no derivatives. This is everything allowed by symmetry of the problem. The one thing you might object I've left out is things that involve three left movers, one right mover. But you can see those always involve these oscillating minus one to the J factors. And that will remain true even if I put in longer range Hubbard interactions.
Actually, so that will change the 4 and the plus.
So these numbers 4 and 1 and 2, these will change, but the actual coupling, the actual terms, the types of interactions I get will not change. So in fact, eventually I'm going to see that I've got kind of a phase diagram depending on the values of these coupling constants. And indeed, the behavior of the model will be quite different depending on what values they take, but any macroscopic model will just sit somewhere in the phase diagram. Okay, so the next topic really is renormalization group.
So what you have done so far is that you get the Fourier transform of the type of the data.
Yes.
Right, then you, the long range property you use when you just go from summation to integration.
Yeah, also I've assumed that psi left and psi right very slowly, and that, if you like, is the reason I've dropped derivative terms. So I've dropped derivative terms here.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I guess at the most simple-minded level, they don't arise anyway. Okay. Simple-minded level, I just write this expression. Well, if you like, I already did something you might have objected to when I dropped terms at the minus one to the j's. You know, why could I have done that? But it's related to it. I mean, the reason I can drop the minus one to the j's is because I've only kept small momentum Fourier modes of these fields very slowly. Right? If the fields varied rapidly, then in principle I should keep minus one to the j. It's going to pick up additional contributions. And in fact, the separation into right and left movers wouldn't even really be well defined. I mean, this formula would be kind of ambiguous or meaningless unless I was assuming psi right and psi left only had small Fourier modes. So the whole point is based on breaking up the low-energy excitations into excitations near these two Fermi points. And at a more sophisticated level, I'm saying if I didn't just completely discard higher momentum modes but actually integrated them out, then I would generate derivative terms. But they're not going to be important here. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to discuss was the renormalization group. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I'm sure that most people in the audience are fairly familiar with it. But one can certainly do a renormalization group for this Hamiltonian, and one can do it, for example, diagrammatically. So again, what I really mean by that is we start with this Hamiltonian, and then we imagine reducing lambda by integrating out modes. And what this does is it gives corrections to the coupling constants. So I could put various names. I'll give these coupling constants names, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, etc. And these various coupling constants are going to depend on my choice of cutoff scale. So as I reduce my cutoff scale, which is the basic renormalization process, these coupling constants are going to gradually evolve. And the idea of a renormalization group is to study the evolution, or one of the ideas at least, is to study the evolution of these coupling constants as I lower my cutoff scale. And the idea, roughly speaking, is that if I want to study physics at some small momentum scale lambda, it's convenient to reduce my cutoff down to that scale in order to figure out how the system behaves on those scales. And if we start with weak coupling constants, we can do a renormalization group perturbatively, and it basically corresponds to calculating diagrams. So what I wanted to just mention as a result of doing lowest order diagrammatic perturbation theory for these coupling constants. In fact, let me just mention a simple way of doing it, where it makes it almost obvious what the expressions are up to some factors of two and so forth. So this is a method of doing a renormalization group based actually on operator product expansion. And this is actually explained very nicely in a book by John Carty. And this will be the last point that I'll discuss today. So see book by Jay Carty. Well, it's the only real book he's written. The title is something like Critical Phenomena, Romanization Group and Critical Phenomena, something like that. And so this is a rather convenient and fast way of doing Romanization Group calculations in 1 plus 1 dimensional systems, especially relativistic systems. The basic idea is the following. Suppose we're calculating some Green's function. Or just calculating the effect of Hamiltonian by integrating out higher momentum modes. So maybe we'll think about it in the latter context. So we're doing some sort of we imagine doing some sort of path integral over our fermion operators. We have our unperturbed Hamiltonian, which is the kinetic energy, and then we have various operators, which we'll call OI, and coupling constants lambda I, and these just correspond to these various operators I've enumerated here. If we're trying to do a normalization group perturbatively, what we're basically going to be doing is expanding this thing in powers of the coupling constants. Then we're going to try to understand basically how it is that, for example, at lowest order, we'd like to understand how an effective coupling constant lambda 1 might pick up corrections that are quadratic in the other effective coupling constants. And this can be understood in the following sort of way. So if we expand this thing out, there's also a time interval here. And this should, in fact, be really the action. I'm doing a path integral. So if I expand to quadratic order, I'm going to have a term like lambda I, lambda j, some sort of integral. Let me write d2x for the space-time integral, d2x1, d2x2, some operator at the point x1, some operator at the point x2. Plus a lot of other terms. And now, what we want to understand is how it is that, in some sense, a product of these two operators sort of reduces to one operator, and that will give us, what we want to understand is basically how we're going to get a correction to some coupling constant lambda I, which is quadratic in the two other coupling constants lambda j and lambda k. So in general, we're going to have some I and j here. The idea is basically that when we bring two operators to the same point, in a sense, they can give us back the third operator. And that's sort of, roughly speaking, is the content of this equation. And that the correction we get to this coupling constant is somehow going to depend on what we're doing with our ultraviolet cutoffs. And it's related to what happens when we bring together these two other operators. So considering singularities when we bring together operators is what the operator product expansion does for us. So the idea of operator product expansion is if we have two operators, say O1 at X1 and X, let's call it Z1, where this refers to say is time plus measuring time plus space coordinate. In general, the idea of operator product expansion is when we bring two operators close to each other, what we get is a sum over all the other operators in the theory at the point Z1. We get various powers of Z1 minus Z2. And we get certain coefficients Vi. So this sort of identity is basically what the operator product expansion means. And the content is that a product of two operators close to each other inside some larger Green's function, in the limit where they get close together, we can replace the product of the two operators by a sum over the other operators in the theory. In general, all the other operators occur. Various powers occur here and their various coefficients. The meaning of this formula really is you have to think of this as being embedded in some larger Green's function. So if you have some Green's function involving a lot more operators, and then you take a limit where z1 approaches z2, in that limit, certain singularities occur, and these singularities are basically encapsulated in this operator product expansion. So the power laws and the coefficients are just what you would extract here, and the meaning of this is that there's a kind of universality, so it doesn't matter what the other operators are, you'll get the same powers and the same coefficients in all cases. So there's some sense in which this product of operators is really equivalent to the sum of operators. Well, it's not hard to actually calculate what these powers and coefficients are, especially in this simple fermion model. And once we know these things, we can basically deduce renormalization group coefficients.
Can you say a few more words about the distance scale about z1 minus z2 going to 1 over lambda?
Yeah, so the way we want to think about renormalization group here is one way, well, renormalization group always has to do with kind of reducing ultraviolet cutoffs. So one way of thinking about it is in position space. So in position space, one way of thinking, and this is just directly from Cardi's book, so I encourage you to go and look at it, but here the idea is one way of thinking about an ultraviolet cutoff is you can imagine you don't allow these two points to get closer to each other than a certain distance. So you could have a certain effective, it's a little bit like a lattice constant, it's a certain effective distance. You don't let the operators get closer together than this distance. Then you can imagine gradually increasing this distance, and this would correspond to the renormalization process. So this would be one particular and rather convenient way of doing renormalization. It's not exactly the same as reducing a cutoff in momentum space. It's more based on a position space idea. It's a little bit like a block spin transformation in a lattice model. But one of the important things about renormalization group is there are lots of ways of implementing it, they should all give the same answers if they're done carefully enough. So one way of thinking about the process is by sort of gradually increasing this kind of a hardcore cutoff on how close together these points can get. And now for calculating correlation functions on distances that are large compared to this effective scale, then this is sort of a short distance behavior on the scale at which we're trying to study the physics. So in that limit, we can basically extract the renormalization group from the operator product expansion. So in the case of these, for these operators, as we will see, in general, we get powers which are 1, or rather 2. So it means that when we bring two of these operators to the same point, in general, we're going to get some B, I, J, K, some other operators, OK, of, let me call it Z, I guess, space-time point. Z1 minus Z2 squared. And the important thing will be to calculate these amplitudes, B, I, J, K. In general, we'll have a sum over all K. And now my claim is that these amplitudes, B, I, J, K, are going to be exactly the renormalization group coefficients. And you can see that because when you consider doing this integral, if our basic renormalization group step involves increasing this sort of hardcore cutoff, then we're going to have some integral over the relative coordinate here, some integral over d2z, where I integrate over a range where z is... So if I'm changing my cutoff from lambda inverse to lambda prime inverse, then I'm integrating over some region. Basically, I'm allowing the separation of these two things to correspond to a circle, to basically to a shell with the size between lambda inverse and lambda prime inverse, 1 over z squared. And this gives me log of lambda over lambda prime. So the effect of kind of changing my cutoff a little bit is to basically give me a kind of a, well, it basically gives me a renormalization of my coupling constant lambda I, which in general involves the product of these other coupling constants, lambda j and lambda k. I'm going to pick up a logarithm. So when I change the cutoff from lambda to lambda prime, the correction is going to involve this log of lambda over lambda prime. And the amplitude is going to be proportional to these coefficients b, I, j, k. And in general, I have to sum over j and k.
Is it easy to see why b, I is 2?
Yes, it's because, let me demonstrate it explicitly, next lecture, but it's related to the fact that these operators all have dimension 2. They're products of 4 fermion operators. And in one space, one time dimension, fermion operators carry dimension 1/2. So these are all dimension 2 operators. And in general, as you know, you can get these these powers by considering the scaling dimension of the operators on the two sides. And if all three operators have dimension 2, it would follow that this would have to be 2, which is the case here. So, this formula always works in 1 plus 1 dimension anyway. Yeah, it has generalizations, I guess, to higher dimensions as well. And it works in the case where we're dealing with, it works nicely in the case where we're dealing with so-called marginal operators, so that these are logarithmic divergences. And that in fact is the case here. So what I need to show you next time briefly is that, first of all, if I actually look at these operators in question and calculate these operator product expansion terms, then indeed I get a power 2, and to try to extract these coefficients bi, and this will be a quick way of getting the normalization group equations. But it's equivalent, in fact, to what you can get by many other standard diagrammatic methods. So I just mentioned this one because it's actually a relatively fast way of seeing which coefficients are zero or non-zero, because we just have to look at what happens if you bring two operators to the same point, which operators can they produce? And that's constrained to a large extent by the symmetries carried by these operators. So, for example, if you bring two operators only involving charge currents to the same point, there's no way you're going to generate a spin current. You can only generate things involving charge. So this formalism nicely relates to the idea of spin-charge separation. Yep? But by scaling dimension, all I really mean is if I calculate a two-point correlation function, it decays with the power law, which is given by twice the scaling dimension of the operator.
So
it's
not a
coincidence? No, it's more or less a definition, I think. So definition. So in general, if I have a two-point function for some operator in one of these theories where everything is power law behaves, in general, this will decay with some power. The power would often be called mu. It's kind of a correlation exponent. But I'll write it as 2x, and x is, by definition, the scaling dimension of the operator. So that's just the definition, if you like, of scaling dimension. Okay. But the point is, these operators all have scaling dimension 2, and it follows from more or less dimensional considerations that these powers have to be 2. Yeah, it's an identity. It's believed to be an identity in general in quantum field theory at short distances. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's a completely rigorous and completely general proof, but there are sort of many special cases and examples where you can check that it makes sense. So, I mean, in general, you can check it in the following way. If you can calculate some four-point correlation function in some quantum field theory, either perturbatively or exactly or by any other method, then you can just look at it and see what happens when you bring two points together. And you can compare it to the sum of three-point correlation functions that you would get where you replace two of the operators by one and put in these coefficients. And you can see that in every case that's ever been checked, in fact, this works. So it has to do with a kind of locality property of quantum field theory. In some cases, one has rigorous proofs, I guess. I don't think there's a rigorous proof in general. So this idea, by the way, I think was first proposed in general by Wilson, and it's kind of tied up in various ways with normalization group ideas.
Well, the conformal field theory is a hypothesis,
the free Dirac fermion is a conformal field theory. You can calculate everything exactly since it's free, and one has exact power law behavior for all correlation functions, and along with that, one has conformal invariance. What happens to the theory once you add these interactions is much less clear, and that will be the topic of my next lecture. So, I guess that's a good place to stop for today. So I hope that these notes will be on the web later today, or if they aren't, you can get a copy from me. Also, you can get my Lesouche notes from me. I guess that's funny. Gives me his copy. Oh, the next question is, what time is the next lecture? Has that been settled? Yeah? Or Harjeet? So the day is Tuesday. So it's next Tuesday at a time to be announced, I guess. Next week on Tuesday is the next lecture. I think you said Tuesday. Yeah. But the time is not fixed yet.